Today, it's the issue of gender-based abortion. It's illegal in the UK, but is so common in some other countries like China and India, where it is also illegal, that campaigners say an entire generation of women has been wiped out. There's been little official research on whether the practice is carried out in some of Britain's immigrant communities here in the UK, although there was a Daily Telegraph expose which the government responded to by launching investigations into some abortion clinics. And Earl Howe, a health minister, disclosed that the government's preliminary statistics from research that they were carrying out and said that the birth rate, the birth ratio, I should say, of boys to girls is within normal limits. They were looking at the years 2007 to 11, but did find some gender ratios varying depending on the mother's country of birth. So it's something that the UK is almost waking up to the possibility that it's happening on a certain scale here anyway. But the United Nations estimates that worldwide there are 200 million women not alive today who might otherwise be if this gender-based abortion wasn't happening. But it isn't just abortion. Infanticide of newborn girls, murdering newborn girls is part of the picture too. And we'll hear people's first-hand experience of that over the next half an hour or so. In his first ever interview on the topic, the Prime Minister of Pakistan will talk with me about the problem. That's before one. One of the top obstetricians in India has told this programme there are more than 27,000 sex-selected abortions in Delhi alone every year because the families don't want a baby girl. This is Mitu Khurana. I spoke to her yesterday. She's a paediatrician in New Delhi. And when her in-laws found that she was pregnant with twins, they gave her food that she was allergic to so that she'd have to go into hospital. And when she was there, they bribed the doctors to do an ultrasound against her wishes. It revealed that Mitu was carrying twin girls.
Once they came to know that I'm carrying twin daughters, they started forcing me for an abortion, at least to get one of the girls killed, at least to get one of them aborted.
I know you've taken legal action against your in-laws. What have they said? Have they said anything directly to you about why it was so important to them that you didn't have a girl?
My husband is the only son in the family. I mean, he has got two younger sisters. So they wanted a male heir and to carry on the family name forward.
And what did they do to you in the time that you did stay with them while you were pregnant?
I was not given any food. This was a three-floor house and the refrigerator was shifted to the ground floor so that I had to come down three floors even to have a glass of water. I was made to wipe the floors saying that it will cause an early abortion because I was not allowed to squat. And I mean, without food, I was kept without food and water, and then my husband used to be very physically and mentally abusive towards me. He agreed with them. He was with them.
Did you know that was his view before you married him?
No. I mean, I belong to a family where we are just two daughters and my parents have never, you know, discriminated that he doesn't have a son or anything. So this was a cultural shock for me. I did not expect that something like this will happen when I get married.
I know that you left the house eventually after that period of time at the beginning of your pregnancy. What's happened since then?
Since then, I gave birth to my daughters, and after that, my husband and my in-laws came to the hospital on the ninth day of their birth, and they told me I cannot enter the house with two daughters. So they started pressurizing, and they started fighting in the hospital itself that I have to leave one of them in the hospital or give her up for adoption. It was only in December 2005 that I tried to go back to my in-laws with both my daughters, and my mother-in-law kicked down my four-month-old down the staircase.
She kicked.
After that,
she kicked your child.
Yes. Since then, I have never taken my daughters here. I'm a doctor. I'm a trained pediatrician. And if all this can happen to me, then how do I protect my daughters when they grow up?
That's Mitu, a doctor in India. Well, listening to that was Stephen Kennedy, Professor of Reproductive Medicine and Head of the Nuffield Department of Obstetrics and Gynaecology at Oxford University. Rahul Tandon, our reporter, is in New Delhi. And Dr. Punit Bedi is an obstetrician and gynaecologist, also joining us from New Delhi. Good afternoon to all of you. Stephen Kennedy, first of all, let's get some basics out of the way. How soon into a pregnancy can you definitively tell the sex of a baby?
Well, it depends very much on what technique you use to determine the sex. In a country like India, the technique that would be used would be ultrasound. And you can reliably detect the sex from about 12 weeks gestation.
Right. What other options might there be for testing the sex?
Traditionally, people have used procedures such as amniocentesis and CVS, but since, I think for the last 20 or 30 years, people have relied increasingly on the use of ultrasound.
Which is non-invasive.
Yeah. In a country like India, there's something like 40,000 registered clinics in the country which are allowed to perform ultrasound in pregnancy. Although, of course, telling the mother what the sex is supposed to be forbidden.
Are there any countries in the world where it is legal to have an abortion based on gender preference?
To the best of my knowledge, the answer to that is no.
Right. And what would we expect naturally in a population in terms of ratio?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. Intuitively, you'd expect as many girls to be born as boys, but that's not the case. So in this country, for example, there are roughly 950 girls born for every 1,000 boys. The problem is that in countries like India and China, the discrepancy between girls and boys is much, much more marked. So in India, for example, on average in the country, there are roughly 900 girls born for every 1,000 boys. Although, of course, there's tremendous variation across the country. In Punjab, it's been estimated, for example, which is one of the worst states in India, that something like 15% of all female fetuses are aborted.
Mm. Well, let's talk to Dr. Punit Bedi in New Delhi. Good afternoon to you.
Hello.
What's been your experience of how common it is for a woman to come to you and ask for an abortion because she's carrying a girl?
Well, I've been a campaigner or an activist of some sort for almost 30 years. So, I mean, it's well known in this country. Not many people approach me directly. Only when they find out, they just go to other doctors. But in the beginning of the problem, which is the 80s and early 90s, practically everyone would want to know whether it's a boy or a girl, especially if they already had a girl. So it's not... the problem is with the second or the third girls, which would have been born... are not allowed to be born now in the last 20 years. So virtually a quarter of all girls, let's say if 100 couples get married and they have a child each, 50 of them would have a boy and the other 50 would have girl. It is this 50 which the ones who have a boy may or may not have a second child, but the one who have a girl will go ahead with an abortion. So basically a quarter of all girls being conceived are being
aborted.
Before
yes.
Birth.
Yeah. Do you? What do you want the government to do in your country? Because you've talked there about you're a campaigner and an activist about it, and I know that some doctors are offered bribes and what have you. So clearly, there's a lot of underhand stuff going on.
So, see, to start with, they trivialize the whole issue by calling it a social evil. You know, it really, when you call it a social evil or a cultural practice, you really, you know, wash your hands off and say it's nobody's problem, really. What really happened was in 50s and 60s, we were made to feel that we were breeding too much for our own good. And population cost by the Western NGOs mostly. It started with Rockefeller and Ford funding very large projects for population control. And the whole noise about population explosion, the Paul Ehrlich's book, and sex-selected abortion. And that's when the UN agencies, especially the UNFPA, you know, decided to look the other way. So population control at any cost was the mantra throughout 70s and 80s. So it isn't that the women invented methods of killing their own daughters. It is the government which first funded the project through government projects which are paid for by first the international NGOs like Rockefeller and Ford, and then by UNFPA, and then by World Bank and IMF.
Let me just bring Stephen Kennedy back in, Professor of Reproductive Medicine and Head of the Nuffield Department of Obstetrics and Gynaecology at Oxford University. It's interesting to hear Dr. Bedi talk there about Western NGOs, so aid agencies and the like in the United Nations, because the United Nations now is investigating this as a problem, in some cases as an effrontery and as an affront to civilization. And yet you have a doctor based in New Delhi there, an obstetrician and gynaecologist based in New Delhi, saying that they essentially started it.
That's true. But when it was started, from my reading, no one imagined how extensive it would become.
Yeah, that's true as well, because it reached epidemic proportions. So the projections were that, whenever it was started, they said that, a few girls dying here and there was a small price to pay, which a larger picture, which was population control at any cost. But once ultrasound came, it really came as a WMD. And within seconds, you could make out. And
a WMD, a weapon of mass destruction, do you mean?
That's right. In places where you don't have drinking water or iron tablets for people dying with anemia, you have an ultrasound in this country. The doctor just told you there's about 40,000 registered clinics. Actually, there are about 70,000, 80,000 now. And there's as many which are unregistered. So they're almost like 250,000 clinics
Stephen,
with small portable machines.
And ultrasound has also become so much easier to acquire. For small communities.
Cheaper
and cheaper.
But in a way, can I just play with a theory for a moment that what you have both just said there about, the initial message of population control, nobody foresaw it that it would go as far as this, of millions and millions of girls and women just not existing because of it. Couldn't you apply the same discussion, the same ethical overlay to the Abortion Act in this country? In the abortion in 1967, nobody imagined it would be used, or perhaps they did, but certainly it wasn't designed to be used the way that it is now, is it? Could you apply the same, Stephen Kennedy?
That is an interesting argument.
But is it one that you can make?
The answer is, I think, yes. The issue here, I think, in global terms, is the sheer extent of the problem. You quoted a figure earlier of 200 million missing women in the world as a consequence largely of this practice. And remember, these terminations are being performed solely because the fetus is female. The Economist a few years ago described this as the worldwide war on baby girls.
Dr. Punit Bedi, respond to that.
That's true. And ironically, Royal College has periodically taken very firm stance on other ethical, relatively what I consider in sheer numbers, minor issues like female genital mutilation. But in the last 50 years of going through British Journal of Obstetrics and Gynaecology, they've dedicated issues and supplements on the issue. Yet there is a deafening silence on female feticide, which is really a genocide. By all stretch of imagination.
And Stephen,
and I would like that, because a lot of very senior opinion makers of third world countries are actually trained in Britain or are registered with the Royal College and would like a Royal College to take a firm ethical stand on it.
Remember something. These are medical practitioners,
yes,
who are performing the ultrasound scans
As well as the abortions,
and they're doing so for financial gain.
Which is, it's slightly different than here, but not entirely, though, is it? There are some private abortions carried out, aren't there?
On a much, 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 much smaller scale. I don't think one can really compare.
I'm not trying to compare. I'm cautious about having a conversation in which we look only abroad at abortion practice and decide it is wholly wrong and ignore abortion practice in this country. And we know there's some evidence it's being offered in the UK, don't we, gender-based abortion? But I wonder whether an Indian or Pakistani woman living in the UK might argue, using the British Abortion Act, I am under psychological pressure if I have a baby girl, therefore I want the baby girl aborted. Is that any different to me going to a doctor and saying, I'm not ready to have this child, I want this baby aborted? As things stand at the moment, I reckon I'd have more success than the Indian or Pakistani woman, wouldn't I? And I'm just curious about anomaly within that.
Can I come in there?
Please do.
Yeah, what I have always maintained is that we should not confuse it with gender non-specific abortions.
Why?
A right to abortion or a right to become a parent or choose to become a parent may or may not be a feministic, view. But once you know that it's a boy or a girl, or it's tall or short, black or white, that extends the right to a ridiculous level. For example, a right of a raped teenager cannot be the same as that of a socialite who wants to postpone a pregnancy for an inconvenient timing. But once, it would lead to totally Frankensteinian proportions if we choose to abort babies because they're boys or girls, because we do have technology to actually tell you what the IQ of the child would be or where. And in a country with a very large aspiring middle class like ours, they would just abort people just because they are a darker complexion or would not get enough grades in high school or would not go to a medical school or a business school. So I think it's very important for us to sit up at this stage and put a stop right here before it gets worse.
Okay.
And we should not confuse it with the larger debate on right to abortion.
Okay.
That's precisely what the population lobby wants us to do.
No, and I just very much wanted to have that element in the discussion. and thank you. You've given a good account of it as well. Thank you, Dr. Punit Bedi, and thanks to Professor Stephen Kennedy, Professor of Reproductive Medicine and Head of the Nuffield Department for Obstetrics and Gynaecology at Oxford University. Our reporter Rahul Tandon, who's in New Delhi as well, will give us a bit more insight into what goes on in India on this story, and we'll talk to the former Prime Minister of Pakistan about it as well. We've been talking about the widespread practice of gender-based abortion across the world. The UN says a generation of girls and women is being eliminated because of the practice. We'll talk in a few moments to the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, who's going to give his first ever interview on the subject. And Rahul Tandon, our reporter, is in New Delhi. We were talking to an obstetrician and gynaecologist from there just a moment ago. And there's a story in the news today in India which relates to this. Rahul, tell us about it.
Yeah, Sheila, it's another shocking story, but I'm afraid to say every day in the newspapers here you see stories like this. It's from Andhra Pradesh, which is a state in southern India. A 22-year-old woman has gone to the police and said basically her in-laws have been injecting her with infected blood, that HIV blood, because she's had a scan that shows she's going to have a daughter. And the thing is, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be shocked by the stories. And I think the saddest thing here in India is when you pick up a newspaper and you see that story, you are not surprised by it at all. I mean, my daughter goes to a girls' school. I was there the other day, and one of the mothers was saying to another mother, she says, you have one daughter. What happens if your next child is a daughter? And you could almost see the fear in her eyes as she answered that question. She just shrugged her shoulders and said, I pray to God that that's not going to happen. You know, there is obviously population control is a factor. But I come from an Indian background. Indian society itself has to look very closely at why this is happening and why it's happening more often now than it used to do before.
And you've been speaking to a woman whose daughter was thrown out of the family home for having a baby girl. She was thrown out by her husband. Let's have a listen to what she said.
She has one child already. And then she had another daughter. Her husband said, I don't want it as it's a girl. I said, I'll take the baby. But he said, even if you do, I'll not take my wife back. If you have a daughter, you spend money bringing them up, and then they leave you. But if you have a son, they'll stay and look after you when you're old. Also, if you have a daughter, you worry about their safety. In villages, after 6 p.m., girls can't go out as it's simply not safe.
That's an illustration, I suppose, Rahul, of the example that you just gave there in your daughter's school.
Yeah, I mean, there are countless examples like that all over India. Look, having a daughter can be very difficult for the poorer segments of society. There is no social welfare system. People have to fend for themselves. The fear that parents have is that if they have a daughter, she will be married off. And who will look after them in an old age? They also have to pay for her dowry as well. So those are the issues for the poorer sections of society. But the question I think you have to ask is, why is it happening in some of the richer sections of society? You take South Delhi, it has one of the highest feticide rates in India, and it's one of the richest and most educated parts as well. And I think that is the problem that India really has not got to grips with. This is a democracy that faces many challenges. But go into some of the villages of India now. There are not enough women for men to marry. You have brothers who are marrying the same wife because there's not enough women there. And as technology spreads, if you go into rural India now, you'll see those clinics which you can walk into and see what baby you're going to have, what sex of baby you're going to have. You just have to pay a doctor a little bit of money, and that's what happens.
Thank you, Rahul. Rahul Tandon, our reporter, talking to me from New Delhi there. Well, campaigners say more girls are aborted or killed in infancy because it isn't just about abortion. It's about newborn girls being murdered as well. And campaigners say more are aborted and killed in China and India each year than are born in the United States. It's been reported in dozens of countries as well. It includes Pakistan, Bangladesh, Canada, Afghanistan, the US, Taiwan and in the UK as well. Shaukat Aziz was Prime Minister of Pakistan from 2004 to 2007, and he's agreed to talk to Five Live about this for the first time. And before we begin to speak to Shaukat Aziz, let's have a listen to the story of a woman in Tamil Nadu in India. The detail is quite upsetting, or might well be. Over the years, she's had 8 daughters and she has killed each of them because she wants a son. She killed them straight after birth. She told her story to the producer of the documentary called It's a Girl, who's given a special access to her story for our programme today.
Since we weren't having any male children, I killed 8 girl children. I just strangled it soon after it was born. Why keep girls when raising them would be difficult? I felt we could keep it only if it was a male and kill it if it was a female child. I would kill it and bury it. Women have the power to give life and the power to take it away.
Well, that film, It's a Girl, was screened recently at the House of Lords here in the UK and on Capitol Hill in Washington. Let me say good afternoon, though, to Shaukat Aziz, Prime Minister, former Prime Minister of Pakistan. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
Thank you for giving us your time. When you hear a story like that, what comes to mind? What do you think about what's going on?
I think let's step back a bit. The issue of the role of women and how different countries reflect this as a or do think do policy initiatives to get over this issue results from certain fundamental causes. One, it's poverty. Two, it's lack of education. Three, civil society has not really brought the issues out as much as they should. So you can get stories like the ones you just related to in almost any developing country. And in fact, this issue is not, the issue of discrimination against women is not just a developing country issue. I view this as a universal issue. The way it is reflected is different in different parts of the world. But naturally, when you hear the clip you just played, it is very saddening. And the issue should be, what do we do about it? And how do we address this issue in a sort of a universal manner? So first, we have to recognize this is a universal issue. Second, I think income levels and poverty have a lot to do with it. Three, lack of education. And four, the inability of governments to come up with enough legislation to provide a level playing field for women and men in a society.
And can I ask you, it's clearly deeply embedded in some communities, isn't it? I mean, we have evidence of it happening here in the UK in certain immigrant, you know, depending on the nationality of the mother. And the government is investigating that because it's illegal in the UK as well. But how deeply embedded do you think it is? Where does a country like Pakistan or India or China, we'll talk about China in a moment, where do you begin in trying to tackle the attitude that a female fetus is inferior and can be got rid of more readily than a male fetus?
I think these are more prevalent in the developing countries. But even in developing countries, income levels and education, these are the two areas I would work on to address the root causes of this issue. Third, in society in general, we need affirmative action to get women their due right. Even in developed countries, you have underrepresentation in the political process, you have underrepresentation in the job market, you have underrepresentation in terms of board of directors, et cetera, et cetera. So this issue has to be addressed multifacetedly. You can't just take one incident and reflect it as an issue for the whole world. And having said that, clearly in the developing world where income levels are low and education is low, countries who want to fight this issue have to get to a level where poverty is reduced gradually over a period of time. So people do not resort to what they do, selling of children or not having girls born because they need a son, etc. These are all reflections of that. Secondly, education.
Yes.
If a country is illiterate, you will never solve this problem. Literacy will give people a more rational way of addressing this issue. The society will react differently. Third, a free media, freedom of expression. The media can play a major role. For the political process, if there are enough women in parliament who can relate to this issue better than others, they need to be encouraged to be there. Now, in a country like Pakistan, we, through affirmative action, increased the number of seats in parliament for women. That has made a big difference. We had more female MPs in our parliament than the House of Commons or the US Congress. as a percentage of total members. So these are steps which you can take. They may not solve every problem overnight.
No, I'm not suggesting.
You need to be
let me ask you.
In every part of society.
Well, everything you've said to me tells me that you sound like the newest of new men, as we would say in this country. But what about political will in Pakistan? I know you're no longer prime minister in Pakistan, but political will?
Yeah, that political will is very much there, and you will always have in a country of 185 or 190 million people, you cannot say that a certain type of issue will never occur again. But the presence of increased number of MPs in Parliament made a huge difference. Every time there was an issue, they would stand up. First point of order was, this has happened, let's do something about it, find out what the causes are, etc. If there's nobody sitting there, it may not even be raised. Secondly, if the media is not there and it's not free and it doesn't reflect, nobody will even know what's going on.
Yeah.
So I think you have to look at it in a more sort of broader view than just take one incident and relate to it. Third, poverty is a major issue. People resort to these. Nobody wants to destroy their children or not give them the right future.
Because I have to finish, I'm afraid, but I just wanted to ask you while we had you on, and thanks for coming on. I know you've been in contact with the family of Malala Yousafzai, the 15-year-old girl who was shot for wanting an education. And it's been a topic we've covered many times on this program. How is she and how is her family?
Well, I spoke to them once, actually, a few months ago. She's been recovering, and I know that she's back in school. In England, our government, this is the government which came after we did, they were there when this happened, and they have moved the family to England, and the father has a position in the embassy, so they've been very supportive. She's recovering, as far as I know, from various reports. I've been following her progress, but I don't call them and bother them every day.
All right.
Because I think they need their privacy in their life too.
Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us. That's Shaukat Aziz, Prime Minister of Pakistan from 2004 to 2007. We'll look at the situation in China in just a moment when it comes to the numbers of abortions carried out on girl fetuses and infanticide as well on a pretty large scale in China. Right, let's look at the issue of female fetuses and babies being killed or aborted across the world. China is the place we're going to look at now. The Chinese Academy of Social Services, which is a government-backed agency, predicts that 24 million Chinese men might be unable to find a bride by 2020, not far off, because of the severe shortage of women in some provinces. The ratio of boys to girls is so bad. Three women from villages in China have told us their stories for the first time. They gave these details to a charity worker. They don't want to be identified, so their accounts are read out for them. We can't for the moment, it looks like. So when we can, we will, I hope. In the meantime, though, let's talk to Reggie Littlejohn, who runs the charity Women's Rights Without Frontiers. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Good afternoon to you, Reggie.
Good afternoon.
And Sung Mei is a health policy research analyst at Princeton University, who also writes for the South China Morning Post. Good afternoon to you, Sung Mei.
Good afternoon.
Hi. Reggie, let me ask you first of all, one of the women, I do hope we can hear from her in that bit of audio that we're just having a problem with. She mentions your charity. So what work do you do for women in China?
Well, China has the worst sex ratio in the world. The sex ratio in India is about 112 boys born for every 100 girls born in China. It's more like 119, 120 because of the one-child policy, the coercive low birth limit. And so women feel that if they can only have one child, they want that to be a boy. And many of them choose sex-selective abortion. So what we do is we have a network of field workers in China. We are able to identify women who've had an ultrasound, who know that they're going to have a girl, and who have scheduled themselves for an abortion, or who have given birth to a girl and are being pressured by their husbands, by their in-laws, to abandon that baby girl.
And what do you do for them? I mean, do you help them to run away? Do you take the baby from them and have it adopted? What do you do for them?
Well, no, we don't do adoptions, but yes, we do have at least a couple of instances where we are supporting women who are trying to escape a forced abortion and just getting money to them. We give them a monthly stipend to help them just survive while they're hiding from village to village. And we had a little boy born recently under that program. And then with respect to the girls, we don't try to have them be given up for adoption. What we do is we go to these mothers and we say, don't abort, don't abandon your baby just because she's a girl. She's a precious life, and what we're going to do is we are going to give you a monthly stipend for a year to help you support and keep that baby girl.
And
this empowers them,
yes, of course,
to sort of push back against their husbands, against their in-laws who are trying to get them to abort and abandon their baby girls.
And Sung Mei, I'm keen to hear from Sung Mei because we don't have a great deal of time left. Is this issue complicated in China by the single child policy?
In some ways, yes, but I think the fundamental cause, the way I see it, is really the preference of Chinese society for boys over girls. But then, of course, the one-child policy's role in this is that when you can have only one child, then if that child is a woman, then you think very hard about whether to keep that baby or not.
And does the Chinese government recognize that this is a problem? Do they speak about it openly? Do they intend to do anything about it?
Oh, very much so. Many in China, including government officials and academics, demographers in particular, they recognize the seriousness and the magnitude of this problem. And in recent years, the government has used a number of ways to try to reduce this gender racial imbalance, but with mixed results. For example, they have established legal protection to safeguard the rights to life of girl fetuses. They have forbidden the use of ultrasound to discover the sex of the fetus and abortion of female fetuses. But enforcement of these laws are difficult very often. And the government has also engaged in education to enlighten the public, telling them that girls are just as valuable and lovable as boys.
Mm, so it's the same as is reflected in the conversation I just had with the former Prime Minister of Pakistan.
They're trying to give bonuses to parents who give birth to baby girls.
To encourage them to. I'm afraid
the government can't afford it financially.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry we didn't have more time. That's Sung Mei and Reggie Littlejohn, who runs a charity, Women's Rights Without Frontiers. Let me just tell you that the audio that we couldn't get to will be available on the Five Live website, and it's well worth a listen, just given the insights into some of those Chinese women and their experiences of this subject.